access number 10897, reel 1.
Wing Commander Grice, Reel 1. When and how did you join the RAF, please?
I joined in November 1937. And I suppose the reason I joined was because I've always wanted to learn to fly. From the time I could, I started to learn to read, I was always interested in what happened in the to the pilots in the First World War. And then I got very keen later on Alan Cobham's flying circus. I remember it cost 5 shillings to have a flight, and I couldn't afford it, so I had to sit on the ground and watch everyone else have a flight.
Where was this? Where were you brought up?
This was at Harrow, in a little field somewhere near Harrow. And then I remember listening to the Snyder Trophy races. That was a great thrill, to hear those marvellous aeroplanes roaring past. And one thing led to another. My keenness to learn to fly went on. I couldn't afford to learn privately. So the only thing to do was to take a short service commission. As I say, I started in November 1937 when I was 18 and a half.
Was it money that stopped you going to Cranwell?
Oh yes, most certainly. My family weren't at all well off. Anyway, the thought of service life rather appealed. I mean, service life before the war was really quite comfortable. When I joined 32 Squadron later on, I discovered that the working week was Monday, Tuesday, Thursday and Friday. I mean, Wednesday was devoted to sport. And although one was on duty occasionally on a Saturday morning, the rest of the weekend was free. And life stopped in the afternoon at about 4:30. So it was quite a pleasant life. And couple that with 8 weeks holiday a year meant that life was certainly very enjoyable.
Do I understand then that after the war, the RAF was much more intense?
Oh, much more. Much more professional. Comparing the expertise of pilots before the war and after the war is really you can't really just compare the two. I mean, in 1938 my squadron was equipped with gauntlets, biplane with top speed of about 150 miles an hour, and after the war the jets had arrived. Speeds of what, 300, 400, 500 miles an hour were possible. Radar had been developed, and pilots flew by their instruments, and we flew, as they used to say, by the seat of our pants.
Was it easy for you to get the short service commission?
Well, if you remember, no, you won't remember, of course. In 1936, the government started to get very worried about the size of the Air Force, and they had plan after plan to increase the number of aircraft, increase the number of pilots. And one of the quickest ways of increasing the number of pilots was to offer these short service commissions. They were for 4 years. You got a gratuity of £300, a lot of money in those days, at the end of your 4 years, and the chance of joining a big company like ICI to do a management training scheme. Of course, in November 37, the prospect of war wasn't really very apparent. There was a lot of unease, but certainly there was no thought in my mind that 2 years later a war would start.
Would that have made any difference to you about joining the RAF?
Oh, not a bit, no.
What about the training that you had? Can you describe the quality of that?
I would say it was very good. I started to learn to fly at, number 28 Elementary Flying Training School at Woodley near Reading. And that was equipped with two types of aircraft, the old Tiger Moth and a very modern monoplane called a Miles Magister. And I was lucky enough to be chosen to fly or to learn on the Magister, which was helpful later on, because when we went from our Gauntlets biplane to Hurricanes, I'd already flown a monoplane with flaps. So the translation from a biplane for me into the Hurricane was comparatively simple. But certainly, I don't think I was any better or worse than anyone else at learning to fly. The curious thing is that it's really very simple. There's only one thing you've got to learn, and that is to judge your height above the ground when you're landing. There's nothing in everyday life which teaches you that, because everything happens in the same plane. So you practice your landing, and initially you tend to land either 10 feet above the ground or 10 feet below the ground. Once you've mastered that, flying couldn't be more simple.
So in those days when you were training, you didn't feel that there was any pressure because of the political situation?
Oh, none at all. Well, one read the newspapers and one got an impression that something was happening in Germany, but it was all rather distant. Anyway, one was very young. One was more interested in what was in the present rather than what was going to happen in the future.
What about the question of choosing between fighters, bombers, float planes, Army Corporation and so on?
Well, after I left Woodley, we went on via Uxbridge, I come back to that, to an RAF flying training school. This was at Sealand, near Chester, where you went for 6 months flying on ex-service machines. The 6 months course was divided into two terms. In the first term you flew a biplane called a Hawker Hart. That had been a first-line bomber in the early 1930s. And in the second term, you flew either a Hart or an Audax, that was another biplane, or a Fury, another biplane, but a former fighter aircraft. And you could choose whether you wanted to become a bomber pilot or a fighter pilot. Of course, I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew I wanted to fly Furies because they were marvelous aerobatic aircraft. And at the end of the second term, we were all asked what service aircraft we'd like to fly in a squadron. And you were given the choice of bombers, flying boats, or fighters. Well, I thought the idea of a flying boat would be great fun. I mean, you would be abroad. So I put down for flying boats, and the RAF, in its wisdom, sent me to a fighter squadron.
And this squadron was which?
This was 32 Squadron at Biggin Hill in Kent.
Can you tell me about the equipment and constitution of the squadron?
At that time, in August 1938, the squadron was equipped with Gauntlets. Lovely little aircraft, very responsive, but of course rather slow. I suppose it had a top speed of about 160 miles an hour. I didn't have to fly for very long because within a month, we started to be re-equipped with Hurricanes. And that meant flying an aircraft which at cruising speed did about 240 miles an hour, about 100 miles an hour faster than you were used to flying. And that, as I say, it was a monoplane with flaps. That didn't worry me. But what was rather startling was the Merlin engine. It was so powerful. That took a bit of getting used to. We had fixed-bladed propellers, I remember, which meant a very long takeoff run, because you accelerated rather slowly. Once you were in the air, it was fine. But what a thrill to be flying so fast.
Did you find that there were any problems or vices with the Hurricane?
None at all. It really was a vice-less aircraft, and so rugged. I mean, you could virtually fly it into the ground and it would just bounce up and land by itself. No, it literally had no vices whatsoever. Unlike the Spitfire was a bit tricky because it had a very narrow undercarriage. And the only time you had to take care was taxiing on the ground, because both the Hurricane and the Spitfire had this big nose, so you couldn't see ahead. So you had to taxi by going left and then right and left and right.
What about the personnel of the squadron and its leadership?
Our first squadron commander was somebody called Reggie Pine, who I think had been a First World War pilot, as I'm sure he had. A most delightful chap. The station at that time was commanded by one Wing Commander Locke, Fiery Locke he was called. And so I was told the sobriquet was because he'd flown in the Middle East in the early 1930s. His engine had failed and he'd come down in the desert where some Arabs had taken him and put a rope round his neck and walked or dragged him behind a camel for I think 3 or 4 days with no food and no water before he was rescued, and that gave rise to frightful stomach ulcers, hence the fiery, you see. He was always in pain, poor chap. Well, coming back to the squadron, I was put into A flight, And the thing about A Flight was that all the members were given nicknames. It was commanded by somebody called Pat Connolly, who sadly was killed out in the Far East in 1941. He was known as the Bulldog. And the reason for that was quite apparent if you'd ever seen him, because he looked exactly like a bulldog. His number two was Michael Crossley, who did very well later on. He was Red Knight. Why was he a Red Knight? He was a debonair old Etonian with a very great presence. I mean, he looked like a knight for a start. There was another delightful chap called John Milner, who never took life very seriously. He was a great artist, marvellous golfer, smoked like a chimney, mostly Camel cigarettes, but was a dreamy sort of individual. So he was nicknamed Millie the Moocher. I think there was a cartoon, no, Popeye. Was in the Popeye films, there was a character called Millie the Moocher. So he was Millie the Moocher. We had two sergeant pilots, Proctor and White. Proctor was called Hector, I think largely because of a sense of alliteration. I think Hector Proctor, they seemed to go together. And Sergeant White, of course, had to be Chalky, because every White in the Air Force became Chalky. Well, I had already acquired a nickname by then, and I was always known as Grubby. Extraordinary. And this arose on literally my very first day at elementary flying training school. I was meeting 20 chaps, I suppose, I'd never seen before in my life, and we were introducing ourselves to one another. And I was introduced to somebody called Vawks as Douglas Grice. And he looked at me, took my hand, said, Grice, Grubby Grice, hello Grubby, and went off the top of his head. And literally from that moment to today, I've been known as Grubby. My wife even gets letters addressed to Mrs. Grubby Grice because people don't know my first name.
So it wasn't because of a lack of smartness on your part?
Oh, not in the slightest. Or because of my appetite.
What was the morale like in the squadron?
Oh, tremendous. On September the 3rd, 1939, I seem to remember listening to the wireless, as it was called, hearing the announcement that we were at war with Germany. And there was, a suppressed cheer. The thought that, at long last, we would earn our keep. It was really quite exhilarating. We didn't know quite what was going to follow, but at the time, we were all fully trained, or as trained as well trained as we could have been. For fighting, and we didn't know then that our tactics were all wrong. But anyway, we could fly our aeroplanes rather well.
Why were your tactics all wrong?
Well, they'd never been tested in warfare. I mean, unlike the Germans, who had the Spanish Civil War to practice in, we had a set series of attacks. They were numbered. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and 6. And there were various manoeuvres we had to go through, like going from flying in Vic formation to flying in line astern, attacking bombers from above, behind, the side. none of which was the slightest bit of use when you came to the point of actually finding the enemy and wanting to fire your guns. It just didn't work out.
Were you training to tackle bombers or enemy fighters?
Or both? Bombers. Bombers. And so far as I'm concerned, I think I only fired on three occasions at bombers. The rest of the time it was mixing it with ME-109s or ME-110s. And the reason for that was, of course, we were always flying in penny packet numbers. So if you attacked a bomber formation, there was a cloud of 109s above it. And because we didn't know any better, we would go round to the back of the bombers and attack from the stern, by which time a lot of the 109s were pointing very definitely towards you. So you couldn't go on to attack the bombers without dealing with the 109s. I mean, if there'd been two or three squadrons, one could have dealt with the 109s, leaving the other two to attack the bombers. But we were rather short on the ground, and the powers that be in those days, I'm talking now up to the time I left the scene in mid-August 1940, the powers that be didn't have the resources to send up more than one squadron at a time.
Before we actually go on to the war, can you tell me about Biggin Hill as an aerodrome? Because obviously it's become a famous name in the RAF. What was it like in those days?
Well, it was a grass airfield to start with, of course. There were no runways. They weren't necessary with comparatively light aircraft like the Gauntlet, a biplane. Apart from 32 Squadron, there was another squadron there, 79 Squadron, recently formed by taking some pilots from 32 Squadron to form the new 79 Squadron. we always considered ourselves rather superior. I can't think why, except that was... that was a matter of morale, I suppose. We were a great team. We all got on extremely well together. We had a very... After Fiery Lock, we had a station commander who had been a First World War fighter pilot called Richard Grice. Curious, same name, but no relation, as far as we could see. And he was an excellent station commander. Everyone liked him. I mean, later on, when we were doing flying in the war, he was always at the dispersal point when we came back with a car with a lot of sandwiches and beer in the boot. You know, he was there to greet you, find out what had happened.
When the war started, what kind of duties did the squadron assume?
Well, from September 1939 till, well, when the real war started, May 1940, we flew either from Biggin Hill or Hawkinge or Manston. Hawkins and Manson being our forward airfields. On convoy patrols mostly, or protecting shipping going from the South Coast ports over to the French ports. Never more than a section of three aircraft. So it was a case of stooging up and down over a convoy.
How was it done? Just circling round?
That's all, yeah. Terribly dull.
Were you ever attacked?
No. No, none of us had seen the enemy until May the 10th, 1940. Actually, that's not quite true. I remember now, in October or November 1939, the Germans flew a reconnaissance, Dornier, down the east coast. And it was plotted by radar. About 20 or 30 miles out to sea, it came all the way down the east coast and then disappeared back to Germany. One or two attempts had been made to intercept it. And on this particular day, this particular reconnaissance aircraft was flying very much closer to the east coast than it had ever done. And three aircraft were ordered off from 79 Squadron to intercept it. And they did, and shot it down. That section was led by an American who joined the Air Force some years before, an American called Jimmy Davis. And I actually saw him shot down and killed in June of the following year, 1940.
How did that happen?
We and 79 Squadron had escorted some Blenheims on a bombing raid. This is after Dunkirk. And we were coming back. 79 Squadron were the top cover squadron. They were flying, as it were, behind us and higher. And we'd crossed the French coast on the way home and were thinking, well, that was that. And I happened to look behind, and there I saw 79 Squadron, about 2 or 3 miles away, I suppose, and 2 or 3 thousand feet higher than we were, suddenly attacked by a whole gaggle of 109s. And we were too far away to do anything about it. So we just went on flying, and I kept on looking at the battle. And suddenly I saw the battle, as it were, break up, as they do quite quickly. And one Hurricane was flying by itself, homewards. And suddenly I saw a 109 start diving down on this single Hurricane. And I shrieked a warning over the RT. The Hurricane went on straight ahead. So I turned round, and from a distance of at least a mile, I suppose, fired my guns across the bow of the Hurricane to wake it up. But again, the Hurricane just went on straight and level, and I saw the ME-109 open fire, because I could see its traces. And it just fired one burst and drew away, and the Hurricane just turned over very gently and dived straight into the middle of the channel. But at that stage, I had no idea who was...